name is Richard Shattuck. I'll be chairing the October 17th meeting of the Planning Commission this evening. Welcome. Glad that you're with us. Let's start with introductions. The gentleman to my left.
Alan Beam, Central Kitsap.
Okay, and then our commissioners online.
Stacey Smith, representing South Kitsap.
Harry Kaltenborn, South Kitsap.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Okay, thank you. Let's spend a few seconds, if we could, talking about our protocol for this evening. We're in a hybrid meeting, which means that you can participate both here in person or online. We'd ask you first, if you could, to please silence all electronic devices during the course of the meeting. And if you're attending in person, please refrain from conversations with other attendees or staff during the meeting. If you wish to comment, we'll have two separate comment periods, and there's different ways you can accomplish that testimony. First, for those attending in person, I think Amanda has a sign-up list at the back of the room here. Please sign up, and she'll take hold of making sure that I know that you would like to provide some testimony this evening. Second, virtual attendees can raise their hand on the raise hand button at the bottom of the Zoom window, and your name will be called and your microphone will be unmuted so we can get your testimony. Third, if you're calling in this evening, you can signal by pressing *9 on your keypad, your last four digits of your phone number, and you'll be called and then connected. You may need to dial *6 to unmute your phone. Finally, it's important to note that we do accept written comments and testimony. If you can, if you have testimony you'd like to present in that fashion, simply submit your comments to staff. We ask you do that by 2 p.m. on the day prior to the meeting. The email address for those comments are awalston@kitsap.gov. And we'd ask that you please include the date of the meeting and that the day of the meeting your comments are focusing on and your name. And then comments will be read at the appropriate time during the course of the meeting. For all folks that are commenting, we'd ask that you please state your name and the general area you live in. And the comments are usually limited for 2 minutes during our public comment period and 3 minutes during the course of formal public hearings. We won't have a public hearing tonight, just the comment periods. And these times can be adjusted by the discretion of the chair and depending on our time frames as well. All right, so that's our protocol. Thank you for bearing with me through that. We have an agenda that's been presented. There was one change to the agenda, and that's with the minutes. We're going to defer those minutes for one more meeting. So do I have a motion to adopt the agenda as presented or as amended? Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all those in favor? Raise your hand, please. Okay, unanimously adopted. We're now going to move into our first general comment period. So if you do want to address the Planning Commission at this time, take one of the steps I mentioned during the course of our protocol information. Amanda, do we have anybody online?
We have a few attendees, but I don't see anyone with a raised hand, so I'm going to go ahead and assume that we don't have anyone wishing to comment just yet, at least maybe not
okay.
For this period.
All right, so we aren't showing here in the room that anyone has raised their hand wishing to speak at this time. You will have an opportunity to speak again at the end of the meeting. Okay, so with no comments presently, let's go ahead and move forward into the meat of our meeting. And Mr. Baker, if you could address us, please.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me. I apologize if I'm the meat of the meeting. I don't have quite as much. You're not going to have quite as much of a dinner as I think I am the main course. So what we have today is I'm here to kind of continue our conversation about the comprehensive plan. The Planning Commission has requested that we have regular briefings about various components. Last meeting was about climate change. Tonight's meeting, I'm really going to kind of focus on, again, some of the efforts we're doing in regards to code. When I make mention of things like making permitting easier or providing incentives, and hopefully we can do a little bit of a deeper dive. It's not very, I'm really hesitant. I do have more draft information that I just don't want to put out publicly, because the moment I say it, it becomes real, and I'm going to see it in public comment for the next year and a half. So I will, it's a little deeper. We're going to get down maybe to the tree level, but definitely not down in the weeds on some of these. So with that, I'm going to share my screen. All right. Can everybody in the room see the presentation? And everyone in Zoom land? Okay. So again, we're continuing with the comprehensive plan update. A vast majority of what the comprehensive plan is about, while it's an aspirational document that kind of tells us what we want to be when we grow up, the important part to a lot of folks and a lot of state departments is how are we addressing the growth that's coming to the community? That is population, employment, and housing. I always put this up here because over the 24-year period between 2020 and 2044, we're looking at adding about 70,000 people. Current county population is 275,000 people. So 70,000 is a substantial growth over the next 24-year period. Along with that, we are going to be expanding employment, jobs. Some of this is going to be military, but a lot of this is going to be civilian-type jobs. Where are those folks going to live? And then the thing that we have talked about on a number of occasions and is kind of the 800-pound gorilla of the comprehensive plan, how are we going to provide housing that's available to people of varying income bands? And more than ever before, when you look at this growth, a lot of folks are looking at, well, you've already planned to 2036, so you're only really planning for 8 more years of growth. That would be true if our targets were the same as they've been before in regards to how much and what percentages of population and employment we're putting in certain areas. So through Vision 2050, that's the Puget Sound Regional Council's document about growth, and through the countywide planning policies, we are more than ever directing growth into the Silverdale Urban Growth Area, into the city, into the cities, and into both the Fairgrounds area along 303 and Kingston. So yes, we're only planning for 8 years more growth, but we are readjusting where all that growth has previously been planned and putting them into these three areas more so than ever before. And that's going to carry with it greater environmental impacts and greater capital facilities needs than we've seen in the past. So you've seen this slide a number of times before, but again, housing affordability is the thing that we're going to have to wrap our arms around. And a lot of that comes down to diversifying our housing types. Housing's not going to get cheaper. We need to incentivize housing types and sizes to attempt to control the costs of growth and provide housing for multiple income ranges. Whoever you talk to about the housing crisis, it's always someone else's doing. Really, it's all of our doing. It's the market. It is the cost of labor. It's the cost of materials. It's regulation, whether it be environmental regulation or whether it be structural regulation. All of these have added on to the cost, but more than anything else, it's the market. We have people coming to our community that are making higher wages than ever before and are able to spend more on housing. Have we necessarily kept up with the amount of housing necessary for people coming? No. That has also been a contributing factor. But now the state has come and said, hey, all jurisdictions, we don't feel you've been doing a great job providing for housing for people making less than 100% of annual median income. We, state, are going to tell you how to do it. Never a good thing, but I can't say we didn't. We should have seen it coming. We should have been more proactive on these issues so that the state didn't feel the need to take this draconian stretch. It's a significant step towards top-down planning. And that top-down planning is, as I've briefed you before, establishing specific housing numbers per income band for unincorporated Kitsap County and each of its cities. So again, we are really needing to focus heavily because our existing urban growth areas have a large amount of single family zoning, whether it be single family detached or single family attached, and a very small amount of multifamily housing. So condos, apartment complexes, we have a very small amount of that, and we need to be growing more of it over time. Let me pause there. I know a lot of this is just kind of recap, but anybody have any questions about what I've said?
Eric, you said you're going to go into regulations. Are we going to talk about development regulations with regard to the changes made by the legislature here on single-family zoning?
Yes, that is coming up. I'm going to try to pause the varying portions of this.
Okay.
I'll blackjack dealer make this gesture when I'm done. And which case, so, but yeah, that'll be coming up here in a second. So when I talk about multifamily, sometimes people say, well, what are some of the images? When I say multifamily, some people think that I'm talking about 20-story buildings. No, largely for a big chunk of our communities, whether it be along the 303 corridor, we're probably going to be talking about the image that you see on the top there is what they now call podium-style development, where you have some kind of commercial on the ground floor and somewhere between 4 and 5 stories of residential above it. That also could just be 4 or 5 stories of residential without the commercial on the bottom. But honestly, when we're thinking about some of the development we could see in large portions of Silverdale, this is the type of housing that we kind of envision as possible. And then you have, again, some of the smaller, more garden apartment style, 2-3-story construction, like you see down here on the bottom. But the important part of mid-rise and podium style is it provides housing that oftentimes can be cheaper to rent or to own than our single family homes, which are trending in the 500,000 plus range for new, old, all kinds in average. So as I've indicated many times, a lot of this is focused on the Silverdale area, predominantly the downtown Silverdale area. We have a lot of paved surface. That is oversized for the days of the retail boom, is definitely oversized now that retail is not necessarily king. The original parking lots were built for those 2 weeks of a year when people were shopping around Christmas. Now, even those times, there's a massive amount of parking that could be utilized for other opportunities. So when I talk about redevelopment, please don't think I expect everything to get torn down and something else to move in. I'm talking about a better use of land than what we've currently seen. So kind of getting into some of the things that the legislature has put down. Well, for unincorporated Kitsap County, the biggest impact truly is those commerce housing guidance numbers, the ones that steer us to needing almost 7,000 or more units that are multifamily in nature. Currently, Kitsap County zoning has somewhere around 1,800 to 1,900 of capacity. So that is a substantially greater amount that we need to be planning for moving forward. So how are we going to kind of think our way through some of these? Some of these are, again, going through code revisions. We need to ease the development process where possible. And I emphasize where possible. Because when we talk about the easing code, people want to gravitate to the energy code. They want to gravitate to stormwater, some of those types of codes that I don't have the ability to modify in this effort. What we really are going to focus on is zoning. And that comes in two different ways. One, expediting permitting for certain development types. The Department of Community Development is already kind of working on what an expedited permitting process could look like for certain types of uses, whether it be projects with large public benefits like fire stations, hospitals, medical facilities, and potentially affordable housing. We could expand some of that expedited to other projects in particular areas, like potentially multifamily housing located in the downtown Silverdale area. So it wouldn't be multifamily everywhere, but that would be taking some of those parking lots and putting in 3, 4, 5 stories of residential in that area, while still being able to maintain some of the commercial and service-oriented character of downtown Silverdale. But the thing that we've really been kind of focusing the most is what zoning or land use processes really don't get us the bang for the buck. There is a lot of cost, there's a lot of effort, there's a lot of confusion that comes along with some of these. How can we make fewer uses have to go through those processes while maintaining the safety of the buildings and the character of the community? So looking at things, I'll cover a little bit more here in a moment as to what some of those may be. But again, trying to remove certain processes that currently add time. And when you add time, you add cost. And I think amongst all the various expenses that go into new construction right about now, time is probably the most troublesome and the one that can have the greatest impact. The longer you wait, the more money you're paying on carrying costs. So kind of going back to some of the other code changes that Commissioner Shattuck laid out, there's a lot of work that's going, this isn't on the slide, I just want to make sure I cover this so I don't forget it. A lot of it is related to accessory dwelling units and expanding the opportunities for accessory dwelling units in urban areas. So an accessory dwelling unit is a unit roughly between, in our current code it's 900 square feet, that's going to have to be expanded to 1,000 square feet per state law. So there's going to be an increase in the allowed size for an accessory dwelling unit. But generally what those are is those are a second unit, oftentimes called mother-in-laws. They're rentals over a garage. They usually are single bedroom places that people are either renting or their kids are living in there or their parents are living in there while they need care. So these are allowed on existing buildings. Kitsap County Code actually allows 2 of them per lot inside the urban growth area boundaries. So Kitsap County's code actually was a ways ahead of most jurisdictions when we were talking about accessory dwelling units. Also, there's a requirement to reduce impact fees. That's one thing I'm going to cover here a little bit more in incentives, is how can we lessen certain costs of development. Downside is if you start giving away impact fees, someone's going to have to pay for those improvements. It doesn't mean that the improvement is magically going to get paid for. There is now a hole, a bigger hole in the project cost that's going to have to be filled through some other avenue. So with accessory dwelling units, we're going to be allowing them in all of our urban growth area boundaries. We're going to be allowing up to 2 of them. They can be 1,000 square feet, and there is a certain parking parking limitations that we aren't necessarily able to require as much parking as we might have in the past. So one of the things I've been really trying to talk to the public about, every time I talk about greater density, everybody thinks that it isn't in their neighborhood. Honestly, some of the changes that I'm going to be talking about here would affect existing neighborhoods. If you have a vacant lot, if you have a couple vacant lots, if you have a manufactured home or a grossly aging home that is beyond rehabilitation, that lot could turn into something entirely different. So when I'm talking about townhomes, I'm talking about row housing, I am talking about, again, greater density and greater capacity. I am talking about existing neighborhoods as well. So that sometimes piques people's interest when normally they're just thinking about brand new housing developments and or downtown areas, not necessarily their 1970s cul-de-sac development that was built that they assume may never change. So the accessory dwelling unit code I just talked about impacts all of the urban growth area boundaries, including existing residential neighborhoods. Any questions on the ADU portion before I move into this slide? All right. So again, when I talk about we're relaxing code to encourage denser development and more diverse housing types. So we aren't necessarily going to be making single-family detached housing harder. Some people, when I say this, that's what they think. We're not discouraging single-family housing. We are, in many ways, trying to allow people to think differently about their properties. I know you heard me say that a number of times, but we really aren't trying to adjust the floor of development. So what was allowed in the past as the floor is still allowed. We are raising the ceiling on development with most of the proposals you're going to see in the comprehensive plan. So more is going to be available, but you can still do what the current floor of development is in the urban low residential zone, urban medium residential zone. May that change in the future? We will have to see how raising the ceiling works towards diversifying our housing types. But what we're largely talking about here is if you go through our code, we have a density and dimensions table, and every zone has dimensions for how wide your lot can be, how deep your lot can be. It has setbacks, how close you can be to the road, how close you can be to any property lines. And in many cases, if you can't meet those or you want to do something different, you have to go to something that's called a performance-based development. That is a land use process, a separate land use process that you need to do to be able to do things. And it's obvious to see how that is a discouragement to doing attached housing. It's a discouragement to doing a number of things just because you can't meet the 60-foot width or the 80-foot depth, or you want to be closer to the road than the 20-foot requirement. So when I talk about removing particular opportunities, by removing particular barriers, we are looking to remove lot sizes and dimensions, potentially wholesale, to allow people more flexibility in developing their lots. I've talked many times about increasing allowed heights. A lot of this is not focused on the single family zones, but focused on the multifamily zones. A lot of our caps have been in the 45-foot high area. Again, very short for multifamily housing. But what we would be looking at is potentially increasing those instead of making it only incentive-based. We could go to 65, 85. Or in certain parts of Silverdale around the hospital, 125 feet high. So again, these heights again allow for greater densities, which when you see this bullet beneath says increasing densities. So that is some of the examples that I've mentioned in previous presentations is instead of capping out at 30 dwelling units an acre in urban high or our commercial zones, we're now going up to 60. Or in certain portions of Silverdale, we have no density cap. You're only capped by the amount of height you're able to achieve in that zone. So again, trying to remove some of those barriers to try to convince people to develop smaller housing on what are some very challenging lots, either because they're already developed to some degree or they have critical areas or something else. While I'm also talking about single family residential, we are talking about increasing the urban low is 5 to 9 dwelling units an acre. We are looking at increasing that to 5 to 14 dwelling units an acre. So now you have greater density, be able to do more attached housing in existing and new development. But to go over 9, you would have to do some kind of missing middle, townhomes, duplexes, some other type of housing beyond single family detached if you wanted to crest that 9 dwelling units an acre. So we are talking about increasing densities across all of our urban areas. And then reduced parking requirements. This, obviously, the developer is going to put in as many parking spaces as they feel they need. The market still says, I need blank number of cars, no matter what the county says. What we're looking at doing is reducing that number of parking stalls. So again, allowing the market more flexibility to work with transit, work with some other opportunities. And then also we are going to be allowing 1 stall and a 2-stall garage to be considered towards your parking calculations. We've never done that before. Garages were always considered to be like my garage. You don't park a car in there. That's where you store all your stuff. Now we are going to consider one of those 2 bays to be considered parking. So if you have to hypothetically have to provide 2 stalls per lot, one of those stalls could be considered inside your garage for the first time. Again, the market is going to drive how much parking they provide, because ultimately if we could drop it down to 0, but nobody is going to want to buy a house with no parking. Even if you do have a garage. So So the market is going to drive a lot of the parking discussion. And then I go back to, we're also looking at not just removing the requirement for a performance-based development for creative site design, like changing lot dimensions, changing lot sizes. We're also looking at, does everything we have on our use table have to be an administrative conditional use permit? That's a land use process. Can it go down to a permitted use where we're still going to review for parking? We're still going to review for access onto roadways. We're going to do a lot of the things that an administrative conditional use permit would do. But we are removing that need for a land use permit that then has its own process that oftentimes eclipses the building permit, the site development activity permit, all the other permits that go along with it. So again, how can we remove process that does not provide the benefit while still maintaining the safety of our community? Every time I talk about any of this stuff, they're like, well, you're making my community less safe. No, we have to look at all this through the lens of, how is a fire truck going to still be able to get to these places? How are we still going to be able to provide all the necessary services and to ensure that people are safe in their homes, in their apartments, in their rentals? I'm going to pause there because that was a lot of words. And we have Mr. Shattuck politely raising his hand.
Yeah, well, I guess it's used to doing things. We talked a lot about ADUs. I assume we're also looking at changing some of the requirements for accessory dwelling quarters. I know some of the things were fairly tough, where you wanted to do accessory dwelling quarters, you had to keep the same roof line on the quarters as you do for the rest of the house, fairly expensive modifications. So I assume we're looking at that as well.
We're looking at some of that as well. The state statute didn't necessarily come down as firmly on accessory living quarters, and we are relatively flexible in those, but you're all right. The common roof line has been a challenge. It is one that is on our list to take a look at. But if there are other impediments to the accessory living quarters, please provide that to me, as I will say that is on my radar, but it is definitely on the outer ring. Not as close to the center as it probably needs to be. Mr. Murphy.
Yeah, Eric, thank you as always for explaining things in a way that makes sense to the layman across this board. I really appreciate the way you go about this. I have run into, I'll switch hats now to architect and personal client. I've run into a situation just outside the city of Paulsboro where it turned out it was the water connection that we could not pull off. I heard maybe there was two districts out of, I don't even recall how many we have, but they were actually out of, I'm not going to name them, but they were out of water connections.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we had designed, a replacement home. You talked about a dilapidated house. And an ADU, and there was room to add the two legs to the septic system. Then we went to look at the water purveyor, and it was not available. It is no longer an option. So can you speak to the, I suppose, utility-related discussions like sewer sizes, and talk to us about how that's playing out thus far?
All of our plans through here and all of our policies are going to have a capital facilities plan that goes along with it. So if we're going to be planning for this many people and this many houses, we need to ensure that people can turn on their taps, people can flush their toilets, people can drive on the roads, the pipes and pavement people is what I usually call them. And then we also have to make sure that there's school, that schools can handle all the children, there's enough fire systems, et cetera. So all of what you're going to see being proposed here is going to have a analysis of, is there enough water, and in this example, to be able to connect up units as generally planned. And again, we are doing this as a planning level exercise. This is not at the level that Mr. Murphy, you're doing on your individual project, or even maybe in a neighborhood would do. This is a global plan, but all the water purveyors, all the sewer purveyors, all have to show how they're going to be able to provide this capacity. That is one of the other things that the state statute has really kind of pushed, that we need to make sure we are not creating obstacles, and one of those obstacles would be exactly what you mentioned, a lack of utilities and a lack of planned utilities. So in the capital facilities plan, you should see, I think obviously you're probably talking about the city of Poulsbo's water provision, or it would be odd if it was PUD. Not that you called anybody out, I'm just trying to put the folks together. So as we are kind of walking through that, we're going to show, okay, this is the amount of additional water provision, whether it be pump stations, whatever, it is necessary to bring water to all of these properties. And then from there, it's going to come with a list of capital projects that are going to have to be funded. That is going to come in two time horizons, a six-year time horizon and a 20-year time horizon. Jurisdictions must show that they have the capacity in their first 6 years, that's financially constrained, that they have some kind of funding mechanism to be able to cover those first 6 years worth of capital improvements. Once you get past the 6 years, it becomes a little more aspirational in nature, but you should be seeing those in the documents that come out on the 15th. What I can say is in alternative two, which is where most of what I've described to you lives in the environmental impact statement, that is where you're going to be seeing the biggest capital facilities impacts, the largest list of potential projects.
One other question, if you don't mind, while I've got your attention. So I've been approached actually by both head of DCD in the city of Poulsbo, and now I've had the same discussion with Mayor Wheeler in the city of Bremerton about helping them create pre-approved ADU plans. So I'm in discussion with both of those folks jurisdictionally.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys, number one, have the same concept underway? And or number two, obviously sort of sidebar, can I help in any way? But I just wanted to bring that up as what something jurisdictions within our county are starting to look at.
It is definitely going to be a policy in our comprehensive plan. From my understanding, I don't believe we have anything currently underway on that, but it is something that we could prime, and let me talk to Jeff Remack and see what our level of interest may be in starting that potentially earlier. I'd be curious how far along Bremerton is. I know Bremerton has been talking about this for 4 or 5 years. I was the first I've heard Poulsbo doing it, but again, it wouldn't surprise me. They're usually pretty progressive in a lot of ways. So I think we would love to have that conversation, but yes, that is one of the things that you would be expecting to appear in our policies as things that we either A, probably will not have completed by, well, we could have completed by 24 if we start soon, but definitely will have on the horizon, potentially using the work of Bremerton or Poulsbo as a model.
Thank you.
As long as I don't have to go with the Norwegian architecture that comes along with Poulsbo in a lot of ways, that should be fine.
No, we can pull the gingerbread fascias off just for you.
Okay, there we go. The Swede in me is always jealous. All right. So kind of moving on, again, the biggest issue for redevelopment in Kitsap County is we don't, and this is very blunt, don't have that many blighted areas in unincorporated Kitsap. We have a lot of areas that are not highest and best use, but in general, thanks to our Navy presence and the stability that it provides to our economy, we don't necessarily there's people who are still cashing checks on all of these properties. So how are we going to encourage them to look at their properties differently? Because they have to forego, I know I say this over and over, they have to forego today's check, put a ton of money in for a bigger check further down the road. So again, going back to one of the things that every developer will tell you, the most important thing that government can provide when we talk about reform is reducing permit time. And if you can't reduce permit time, give a date you can take to the bank. If I give you everything you need, you'll review it and you'll give it to me by blank date. That, just being able to achieve that is going to be great, but again, there are certain projects of public benefit that need, again, expedited permitting. We need to shrink that amount of time, we need to shrink those carrying costs to get somebody who owns a piece of property with maybe a run-down convenience store or run-down fast food restaurant to think, okay, maybe I could take this and I could do a couple stories of residential above it, and I could still have some new commercial venture on my bottom floor. That could be done in larger parking lots. Best Buy parking lot comes to mind pretty regularly. So that type of thing, I think, would be beneficial, and expedited permitting will help with that. We're also looking at what we can do in providing regional stormwater and other infrastructure solutions. How can we, because stormwater is a tough nut to crack everywhere, and that's only getting harder. Can we develop regional systems that serve the roads, serve other impervious surface needs that we have to reduce flooding? But build them at a capacity where water quality and water quantity can be served to private development, almost like a stormwater bank in a lot of ways, and allow folks to plug into those. And that's something that the Stormwater Division is kind of looking at, how that could work. That would be a very important conversation to have with redevelopment in places like downtown Silverdale or downtown Kingston. The state statute has allowed us to increase SEPA exemptions. That's the State Environmental Policy Act. That's a review that all projects have to go through. Our EIS is the planning level version of a SEPA review for the plan. There's also a project level SEPA that needs to be done for all projects when, like, subdivisions that are being built, commercial ventures, multifamily housing. There is the ability to reduce the threshold, how many units you're building, how big a development you're building. If you reduce those, you don't necessarily have to go through SEPA any longer. That then again speeds things along. You're still paying impact fees. You're still again having to meet the needs of the road system, etc. But you're not going through a SEPA process that again is another land use process that can take time and has a separate appeals loop in it, and when the appeals loop is triggered, it gets a lot longer. And then lastly, we talked about the multifamily tax exemptions. There's two forms. There's the 8 and 12-year options. I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide, but let me pause and see if there's any questions on this slide. So multifamily tax exemption. That's what I call MFTE. So every time I say that, that's largely what I mean. This is important to the assessor because it is both a tax shift and in many ways a tax exemption. Basically, for today, obviously that piece of property that is being developed is paying taxes, property taxes, that is. Obviously, when something goes into a multifamily tax exemption program, it's no longer paying those taxes. Those taxes get dispersed amongst the remainder of the taxpaying public. And then how is it a tax exemption? As you build the new thing, property tax goes up, but you aren't having to pay that for an 8 or 12 year period. So some people I've been talking to, that's a very important distinction. So I just have been adding that to my presentation to make a complex topic even more complicated. So the 8-year program is allowed for pretty much any type of multifamily housing. So as long as you are developing a multifamily project, you can get up to 8 years of tax exemption. Obviously, if we're going to be looking at this, we're going to be looking at it in areas where we really want to see multifamily housing, and we're really talking about downtown Silverdale. We're talking about downtown Kingston. We are talking about specific areas, not places we're already seeing it, but places that we want to see it over time. And again, not rejuvenating, because Silverdale works fine as it is, but turning it into a 24/7 community versus a 8-to-8 community like it is right now is one of our main goals in this plan. And then there's the 12-year program. Now you get 12 years of property tax exemption. But you also have to provide some kind of affordable housing component. Generally, that's less than 80% of annual median income. That obviously is going to be 4 more years that you're not necessarily paying taxes, but it comes with a requirement to, again, have a certain number of units that are under market and a significant amount of reporting requirement. So that's, now we're moving down into the considerations section. So the considerations section, the reporting requirements in administration. This isn't just the private property owner's concern. This is the Department of Community Development or the Department of Human Services concern, because they need to report who's living in their places, what their annual median income is, how they go about it getting that, whether it's tax statements, et cetera. That's a burden. On top of it, it needs to be submitted to the county, and the county needs to review it for accuracy and compliance. So that's our hurdle. It needs to be thought of, but that only applies to the 12-year program. The 8-year program, you don't have that limitation or that requirement. Do we really want to do these programs on a 4-lot development? Probably not. We're probably going to want to have a minimum size, minimum number of units in the project, or a minimum density of the project. Again, we want to provide this opportunity to achieve some larger public goals, and a lot of that is to bring a lot more people into our downtown areas of Silverdale and Kingston. And then on top of it, do we want to think through, okay, if you're going to do this, you have to have X amount of one-bedroom units, Y amount of two-bedroom units, and maybe no 3-bedroom units. We have a good number of those already. Some families need them, but now you're paying $27,000, $28,000, $3,000. And you're definitely not, you're now 120-150% of AMI. And again, I think we're getting a lot of housing that fits into that category. Bremerton and Port Orchard have these programs. We've been meeting with them, and they have been talking to us about lessons learned. And they've really hit hard on this reporting requirements and administration being not just an impediment, but even if it isn't an impediment, it is a burden that becomes very hard for both the private developer and the jurisdiction to ensure compliance over time. Let me pause there and see if there's any questions. I am actually reaching the end.
Eric, there are some projects on the board that, you know, we heard a lot about a year and a half ago in Silverdale, the purchase of the Jenny Wright building and the library and other things in Silverdale. Are those things being held up now while developers are waiting to see what happens to the tax exemption? Or is there a sense that everybody wants to see how this plan comes out before they pull the trigger on development?
I think that largely everyone's kind of looking at where the market is going at this point. And I think, again, the reason I included this slide, which is one of the areas I would consider highly redevelopable in Silverdale. Not blighted, but definitely has some buildings, either A, that are in public ownership that are no longer being utilized for a public purpose. That's a win-win. And a series of older 60s, 70s commercial development as you move up towards the Oxford Suites, that has a substantial amount of parking, but also has some opportunities for redevelopment. So I think some of the developers are looking at what additional sweeteners the county is going to be providing. So that may be a component, but more than that, they're looking at the market, and they really also want to see how we're going to handle any kind of expedited permit, because obviously the school is a public entity. The school probably has about 10 impediments I don't know about on why this property has not sold yet. But I do know that a number of developers have been looking at it for two things. One, it's a big chunk of developable property, but some members of the environmental community have also been looking at, there is Strawberry Creek under there someplace. You can't see it, it's been tightlined. But there's an opportunity to potentially daylight Strawberry Creek and provide an environmental benefit as well. Those types of features also are quite attractive to development. Yes, they take away from certain developable land, but it also creates a development that stands apart from some of the other complexes you currently see in Silverdale or are being built in Silverdale, as well as other areas of the community. So I really do believe everything, we need to establish a fertile climate for this. And a lot of what we're doing in the 24 plan hopefully is going to be a good amount of fertilizer. And you can fill in your joke there. That it actually successfully makes people start to think, hey, I might be able to do this with my property. I won't say that there may be larger developers who come into our community to do some of this development. We have a lot of very good local developers, but it isn't just necessary, is the local developer interested in multifamily? It is, can those local developers get financing for them? Banks don't like loaning to people who don't have a track record of multifamily development. And of course, if you can't get the loan for multifamily development, you can't develop a track record. So as we're talking about some of this development, there is the, I will say, concern potentially that we aren't necessarily providing opportunities for a number of our local developers. Instead, we're getting folks from Seattle, Bellevue, California, places back east coming in and developing these projects. But hopefully it is going to take a catalytic event. Someone's going to come and show, hey, look how cool this could be, the Jenny Wright CK School District property could be it. It could be one of the Mentor properties. It could be the Best Buy parking lot. But once you start seeing people downtown, you're going to be seeing businesses that are coming in that are looking differently. They aren't necessarily catering to the traveling public, that we aren't working just strictly on roadways to get as many people in and out and through as possible. We're working more on walkability. So short answer to your question, yes, I think some people are waiting to see exactly what we're doing in the 24 plan, but I think also there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes as people work to acquire assemblages of property. Because one of these little parcels here probably is not going to be enough. You're going to need to acquire a number of these properties. A lot of them are owned by the same people, so it's a little bit easier, but you're going to have to do an assemblage to be able to pull some of these off. So I think some of those may be in the works. I do put out the fact that that could be bringing larger developers to town, which will make ensuring that we are flexible with our code, but we aren't allowing folks to come in and totally take advantage of the community and drastically affect the quality of life like a lot of people are afraid of when I give this presentation out in the public. Any other questions? So to sum up, again, I always want to highlight where we are. We are currently sitting right in between this blue box and this green box. We are currently finishing up the draft environmental impact statement, comprehensive plan goals and policies, capital facilities plan, and development regulations for release on December 15th. It is a Christmas present that will keep you going all holiday season long. And then come January, we are doing a full public outreach. Very similar to what we did before, a lot of in-person meetings, a lot of individual presentations to groups where they are. It's very important for me to go to where people are already having meetings, where I'm not making them come to me, I just happen to darken their door. So we're going to do a lot of that. We're going to have a lot of virtual meetings as well. Because ultimately what's going to happen is people are going to have to take all the information that they get from those three alternatives, and by April, the end of April, we're going to have to create one preferred alternative. And that one preferred alternative, once that decision is made, yes, there's still time to craft code, there's still some time to tweak goals and policies, but that is really the big decision. That is where the urban growth areas are sized, that is where the densities are set, that's where all the big ticket policies are determined. So really, it is going to be that December to April time frame that there's going to be a lot of public comment, and I'm really hoping to spend a lot of quality time with you folks. And then lastly, all the final documents on that one alternative comes out in August for a hopeful adoption by December 2024. So, I spent a lot of time talking about urban areas and housing. While this is a holistic comprehensive plan, we are concerned that the rural areas are getting short shrift, and there may be some need for us to have a conversation about whether certain rural conversations need to be the focus of a follow-on process in 2025, where we could focus on agricultural issues, we could focus on rural character, we could focus on rural clustering, some of the real thorny reclassification requests, like the one proposed by Rainier up north, can be considered during that period of time. So I kind of put that out there as something that's mulling around in our heads, so we could make sure that we are really hitting the big ticket items, which again is housing, population, and employment, and sizing our urban growth areas properly. With that, that's all I have for you this evening.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Baker? All right. Eric, thank you for your time. I really appreciate your being here to keep us up to date.
I think Commissioner Smith may have a question, or maybe she's moved. Oh, no, yes, she has no question.
I do just have a quick question. So you started this presentation by sharing with us our population growth up to 2044, and then we revisited some of the Puget Sound Regional Council's 2050 vision. Remind me, this is my first go around with a comprehensive plan. Remind me the time frame of this comprehensive plan.
This comprehensive plan is 2024 to 2044. The reason I have 2020 here is that is the census data that we have, which is a way that we can kind of lock down a set number. We have to grow that number. But yeah, I just highlight that because if you look at our countywide planning policies, that is the time horizon you're going to see in the countywide planning policies. So I don't want to confuse folks. But before I do leave you, I know that the Planning Commission was very interested in having presentations about the comprehensive plan. And I want to make sure that I'm presenting to you what you want to hear or questions that you have, or if there are certain things you want to have a deeper dive on, I am prepping staff to bring those in. So does any of the planning commissioners currently on have particular topics they have not heard as of yet that they'd like me to queue up for a future presentation? Commissioner Murphy.
I know, I would assume by now, you've seen Mr. Disney's presentation about the cost of building a home as a contractor in our county. I'd be curious, because I know that is making its way through its own circles, that some of those circles overlap with your stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be curious to know, what's your feedback, or what action items do you take from that information? Just for the sake of the commission, I think that Mr. Disney's presentation, which I saw at the Home Builders Association luncheon this month, reflected somewhere conceptually in the neighborhood of, including, as you mentioned, the largest one being interest payments on a loan, that it was costing a builder an extra $126,000 per door to try to get a door out of the ground to the point of getting your keys. Now, you and I both know that varies widely, whether it's an SFR or a 60-unit apartment or. But you guys, I know, have seen this.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love to hear some feedback from you on what's changeable, what's unfixable, what's true, what's not true, what are you doing about it?
All right. Well, yeah, let me get with the Department of Community Development. I've read through it. I have some of my observations on it, but I think it's important for the county to have a set group of comments. So let me get with the Department of Community Development. That obviously is a component of what we've been talking about here on how to make housing cheaper.
Yep.
So it fits into the wheelhouse of these conversations. So I could try to queue that up for a coming meeting.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, do we have anyone else? Again, then, thank you, Rick.
Thanks. I appreciate your time today.
All right, your next item on the agenda is a second public comment opportunity. Amanda, do we have anyone who is showing they'd like to talk?
We do. We have two speakers. Elizabeth Nichols would be first.
Okay.
Go ahead and bring her over.
All righty. Ms. Nichols, I think we've got you. Go ahead.
Hey, actually, this is Elizabeth's husband, Doug Heyman.
Okay.
I just have a combination question around the ADUs. What we've seen in Indianola, where we live, is oftentimes people start renting out their extra spaces, and it ends up being an income source, and then people that are lower income in Indianola can't find place to rent. And then we have large development like Arborwood nearby. So just curious about what can be done to make those, you know, maybe have some kind of constraint where the ADUs are not going towards just, you know, this Airbnb income source and could be used to actually provide for Kitsap residents. And then what can be done so that, you know, we don't just have these large developments that have, you know, $600,000 plus homes, because that's what we're seeing with Arborwood, you know, the first phase and the second phase are going to be really expensive, and they're not really serving the needs of that lower branch that Eric was talking about. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols.
And we've got Mr. Palmer. One second.
All right, Mr. Palmer.
Hi, thanks. I'm kind of skeptical about some of the things that Eric was talking about, one of which was expediting the permitting process for certain projects. If you recall, earlier this year, we had the zoning code update. That was a four-year process to get to that point. We added 100 pages of new regulation in the process. So it was billed as being something that was going to expedite permitting review. And I can't see that it's done anything in that regard. So I'm skeptical. I'm also concerned that, yeah, you put all this development in Silverdale, maybe Kingston, possibly Highway 3 in Northeast Bremerton, and maybe even some in South Kitsap. But you've got a real bottleneck when it comes to trying to get through those places from a traffic standpoint. And part of the Silverdale's bottleneck is right there where Highway 3 joins Sinclair Inlet. There were some improvements to the flow of traffic, particularly in the 3 to 5 o'clock hour, but all they did when they increased travel time on Highway 3 is they backed up the shipyard traffic in Bremerton. So I see that as a real solution. The other real question I have for Eric, and I will get to him directly about it, is, okay, we got 70,000 people coming into the county over the next 20 years. Do we have to have, or is there any consideration to, X number per year has to be accommodated by the plan? And I haven't heard anything regarding that. So in my estimation, we get 10 years into the process and we're like we are right now, some 1,500 deficit in providing housing. And when I say 1,500, I'm referencing the 2020 housing plan that was done by combination of Bremerton and Kitsap Housing Authority. And we're supposed to have an expedited permitting process, but it takes, I happen to represent several building permit applications, and I'm into my fourth year on one of them and have 2 years into the others. And that's because of the complication of regulations across the board.
Okay, Mr. Palmer, I'm going to go ahead and cut you off here. If you would finalize your comments for tonight, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, well, that's basically all I have to say right now.
All right, thank you. Amanda, do we have anyone else?
I do not see any other hands raised.
All righty. Okay, so we don't have any other comments. Do we have any comments for the good of the order? I just have one announcement to remind everyone: we will not have a meeting first Tuesday of November because of the election, and so our next meeting would be in on November 21st. Anyone else have anything they'd like to add? All right. Do I have a motion for adjournment? Oh, come on! Somebody wants to go home. Oh, Mr. Beam wants to go. Okay. Second, Commissioner Murphy, great. All in favor? All right, have a great month. Bye-bye now.
Thanks everyone.
Thanks for hosting, Richard. Thanks for hosting.